for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's July 2022, and this is episode 296, which is a very deep dive conversation about the issue of abortion and the pro-life movement since the overturning of Roe versus Wade by the Supreme Court of the United States in June 2022. On this episode, I'm joined by Jay Watts, who is one of our regular contributing writers. He is also the founder and president of Merely Human Ministries, Inc., an organization founded to equip Christians and other pro-life advocates to defend the intrinsic dignity of all human life. Jay has written a feature article for the Christian Research Journal, and we'll touch on that briefly. His article is called The Problem with Improving Abortion, and since we won't really do a deep dive on that, you'll want to subscribe to our current print issue, Volume 45, Number 1, in which his article appears. If you don't already subscribe, to subscribe to our journal for $33.50, please go to our website, equip.org. In addition, Jay has an article that's coming out that will be covering a lot of the issues that we're going to be talking on this podcast, and that article will be in our next print issue, so you won't want to miss out on it. Jay, it's good to have you on once again.
It is great to be back, as always.
Back in May, on episode 288, I had Jay on to the podcast, and we discussed what was then a leaked initial draft majority opinion written by Justice Samuel Alito, and that draft showed that the Supreme Court had voted to strike down Roe v. Wade. Well, now indeed, the Supreme Court has in fact overturned Roe v. Wade, so I wanted to have Jay on again, and I want to talk to you about the article that you wrote, first of all, about abortion in our newly released print issue, which is Volume 45, Number 1. Again, his feature article is called The Problem with Improving Abortion. But really, I also want to talk to you about the many issues and different opinion pieces that have been published since the overturning of Roe and ask you about what's next for both the pro-life and the pro-abortion movement in wake of this SCOTUS decision to overturn Roe versus Wade. But first of all, I want to ask you actually about the legal issues in Roe, because I think most people on either side of this issue, especially online, are not really talking about the legal issues in Roe and why Roe was overturned. So although Jay's not an attorney, he has worked for many years in pro-life ministry. And so Jay, what happened legally in 1973, when abortion was made legal through Roe versus Wade? For example, that case dealt with written and unwritten rights. And that case also dealt with something called the Palko test. And that was part of the original reasoning for Roe. Now, in this current majority opinion, Justice Alito does reference the Palko test. And that's part of some of the things that are in his opinion. So I just want you to address for us and kind of break down the legal issues that led to Roe v. Wade making abortion a constitutional right.
Yeah. And as you point out, I'm not a lawyer, but I only quote lawyers. So that's the way I keep myself from hopefully getting in trouble legally. What happened in 1973 was, as a groundswell of desire to see abortion legalized started to grow within a particular group of people, right? At the time in 1973, the Roe v. Wade decision comes, 30 states still have strong prohibitions against abortion. So it wasn't like the country had become liberal in its approach to abortion. A particular group of influential people were pushing this. And so when it got to the Supreme Court and the deliberation began, you have a difference between what's called enumerated rights in the Constitution. So the Constitution tells you exactly what rights you have early on when it talks about things like you have a right to freedom of speech, the freedom to practice religion without interference of the state, the freedom of assembly. All of these things are areas of the right to bear arms. And the Second Amendment, which is something we're having a lot of conversation about right now, you're protected from different intrusions by the government into your life. That is something that I think is lost a lot in our current world as well, is the idea that that Bill of Rights was meant to limit the intrusion of the government into your life. And so those limits were drawn. And then in the Ninth Amendment, it tells us that there may be unenumerated rights that exist, and that the idea that they have not been written down, the idea they have not been listed, does not indicate that they don't exist or that the law shouldn't respect them and protect them. And so when you talk about what happened in 1973, when there was a desire for a right to abortion to be found by the justices that were crafting that that decision, what they said was, it's not an enumerated right. You cannot find the right to abortion written in the U.S. Constitution. So you have no constitutional right to abortion that's enumerated. And so they say, but maybe it's an unenumerated right. It's an unwritten right. It's something that will be covered elsewhere. And so the Palko test, which you mentioned earlier, actually isn't mentioned by name in Alito's opinion, but it is in a footnote. It is mentioned. He uses the language of the Palko test repeatedly through his opinion and the majority of opinion, but he doesn't actually refer to it by name except in a footnote. And what it says is, if we're going to identify an unenumerated right, if we're going to identify something that's unwritten, there have to be standards by which we judge whether or not it is an actual fundamental right that you have as an American citizen. And the two standards that are given, the first one is it something that is holding within the traditions or history of the United States? Is there a strong tradition that this is a recognized right among the people of the United States, and it just wasn't something that was enumerated at the time of the framing of the Constitution? And then the second thing that they look for is it implied in the enumerated rights? Would it be possible for you to fulfill the living of an enumerated right without this unenumerated right, without this unwritten right also being protected? So those are the two standards. Number one, is it a part of the history? Is it a part of the fabric and tradition and the history of the United States, and it's just not something that was written down? Or number two, is it impossible for you to live out the other written rights without this right being there to protect those as well, to protect your ability to live free and liberty interest and life interest and things like that? So it's possible to live within the enumerated rights without abortion. And so what is made, the question then comes, is it a part of the fabric or the tradition of the United States, history and the people? And is it something that's always been a part of us? So what they tried to do in 1973 was establish history that demonstrated that it will pass the Palko test. We're going to find an unenumerated right for abortion because it's always been here. And they leaned heavily on two articles written by the same historian, a guy by the name of Cyril Means. The article and the history that he provided has long since been discounted as wildly inaccurate. And even Alito provides evidence in the opinion, the majority opinion, that even the lawyers who were fighting for the Roe v. Wade case said, this is bad law, but it's written by somebody on our side and it'll get us what we want. They recognize that in communication, private communications back and forth with each other that have since become public. So they relied heavily on this history. And then since then, every court of affirmation of Roe v. Wade has relied on the original ruling, saying, well, the original rule, it's been ruled. So they go to what they call stare decisis, which we've talked about before, the foundational idea that like cases ought to, once it's been decided, we have to respect the decision and keep affirming that decision so we don't have chaos at the judicial level. So what Alito does, and Dobbs, and what the majority agree on, is he says, rather than keep affirming stare decisis because it was already decided, we're going to go back and do the Palko test again, throwing out the terrible history by Cyril Means and starting over. Let's just start over and see if there is an unenumerated right, an unwritten right to abortion, if we look at this objectively based on all the information that we have in front of us. And he says, history does not demonstrate a tradition, and it's clearly not something that was a part of the fabric of us as far as traditionally understood. It was against the law all the way up until 1973 and Roe v. Wade, and there's no implicit part of it. There's nothing about abortion that is required to respect all other rights that we have that are enumerated. So he said it fails the Palko test, and so abortion is not a fundamental protected constitutional right that was unwritten because it cannot be found in either history or tradition or implicitly in the other enumerated rights. And so that's it. That is what the case Dobbs just said. It said it was originally established using a false history to pass the Palko test. And it says if we throw out the false history and deal with a broad, and he brings to bear a broad range of legal historians and writings and demonstrates the history and tradition of the United States of it being illegal. He says, if we look at it objectively and don't just punt the stare decisis, if we don't just say it's already been decided, so it's already been decided, if we go back and say, is the original decision a good decision? We find out that it's not. And so then he says, our loyalty to this original decision, which we usually affirm with stare decisis, isn't necessary because it's not a given that we have to affirm bad decisions. In this particular case, we can identify a bad decision wrongly decided that is bad for the country, and we can get rid of it and return this to the states. It should have never been, in Alito's argument, an issue that the courts took the power over all the states away from. It should have always been something that had to be fought out through the democratic processes of voting and local elections to establish cultures that meet the community moral standards.
You know, you mentioned what we've been talking about since what's been, you know, happened now because of the decision in 1973. And so obviously I want to ask this question. There's been a lot of op-eds out there about what the result of this decision would be, but is abortion now illegal? And did women actually lose the right to abortion with the overturning of Roe v. Wade?
It's illegal in some places. At least 13 states had trigger laws so that it immediately became illegal. Is it illegal in the United States? Have the people of the United States lost their right to abortion? Absolutely not. And I say that as somebody who doesn't want people to get abortions and thinks it's a great moral wrong. But as a matter of fact, in places like California and New York, particularly New York, I know the language of their state constitutions or state laws were changed in some of these places' constitutions and some of these places' just laws that were put into effect, where they actually have more access to abortion now. It is more unlimited than it was before, as frightening as that is, given how access to abortion worked prior to this. So there are places where it's not only continues, but it continues more unfettered than before. I know in New York, you're no longer allowed to consider the unborn human under the law in any way whatsoever at all. You cannot have laws that punish somebody for an act against the mother if it ended up in the death of her child, because that would be consideration of the unborn child. And they believe that to be a problem and there. So is it illegal in some parts of the United States immediately when Roe v. Wade was overturned? Yes, it became illegal in many states. Will it be limited or illegal in many other states? Yes, that's going to be happening. There's going to be a restrictions placed, and states are already in the process of getting that going. Is it going to become illegal and impossible to have access to the United States? Absolutely not, because there are certainly pockets of the United States where they're more liberal on this issue, and they have done everything that they can to protect access to abortion for the people that live in those states and have invited people, even offering state funds in some cases to pay for people to travel. And companies have come up and said, I'll pay for you to travel. A lot of companies have stepped up and said, women, we will pay for our employees to travel to states to receive abortions if they can't get them in the state where they reside. So it is not illegal in the United States. They didn't lose a right to abortion. What happened was they are now forced to go on a local level to win their community over to their viewpoint. And if it's as popular as they say it is, which they claim that all the time, everybody loves abortion, everybody wants abortion access, if the majority of people agree with us, then you're going to have no problem convincing them to pass more less restrictive laws and allow people access to abortion at some point or another in the process of pregnancy. So it's not illegal across the United States. And no, whatever laws that are in place right now won't be permanent if they can win people over and get legislative victories at the local level, which they seem to believe they can do. So the idea that they have lost right. And then, of course, Alito would say, you didn't lose a right to abortion because you never had one. Not a constitutional right. It never existed. You didn't lose a right. You just were lied to for 50 years.
The Postmodern Realities podcast gets thousands of downloads every month, and we're thankful for that because it means we have a lot of listeners interested in our content. However, we need more ratings on Apple Podcasts, and in the last 6 months, we've received 2. And as I mentioned last week, we have a winner for our swag for the contest through the end of June. That's Frank C. Schiappone. And we're going to give him another week to claim his prize by emailing us at webmaster@equip.org. If Frank doesn't contact us in the next week, we will give the prize to the other entrant, who is 3745 the Red. So the reason why we'd love it if you give us some ratings and reviews is that this helps other people to find our content and then listen to the podcast and find out more about the Christian Research Journal. So if you're not already a subscriber, we ask that you do subscribe. And for $33.50, not only do you get the journal straight to your door in the mail, but you also receive all the online access to the exclusive content. Now, the print issue articles do not go online for quite some time. So if you want to read some of the very in-depth articles that we have that we feature on this podcast, you will want to get a subscription. But if a subscription is not in your budget right now, please consider giving us a tip for the cost of maybe a coffee that you normally get, if you would sub that out and give us a tip, or maybe what would be a month's of subscription to your favorite streaming platform, and you would like to give us a tip, it's really easy to do that. Just go to equip.org. You'll see magazine. You'll click on that. There's a drop-down menu. You'll see postmodern realities, and at any one of them, which is almost 300. I can't believe we're almost up to 300 episodes in the past 6 years since this podcast debuted in 2016. But at any of the episodes landing page, you will find a link to give us a tip. So we're really grateful for that as well. So thank you for partnering with us by getting a subscription, by telling friends about your favorite episodes, or putting them on your social media accounts if you have them, or emailing them to a friend. We're really grateful. And now back to the podcast and my discussion with Jay Watts. Well, you just mentioned what Alito's response would be to abortion access. And actually, I want to know, how have abortion supporters responded to his claim that the abortion history that we just talked about a few moments ago in Roe was bad history?
I think what's interesting is if you read the leaked draft, it has changed since then. Now, that the substance of it hasn't changed, but it has changed. And he responds to some of the things that people said, not directly quoting articles or editorials where people question the history. Like, for example, one of the things that was questioned by some academics who are supportive of abortion rights, they said that, well, it's not fair to say that abortion was illegal because it was only illegal explicitly written after quickening. So they would say if a woman gets an abortion or kills her child after quickening, so quickening being the point where a woman can feel the movement of the child inside of her, and if it's done after that point, then it's legal. But they say early abortions wouldn't have been. And Alito clarifies some of that. He says, well, let's look. And one of the mistakes that people make oftentimes when we talk about this, and Joseph Delapino, a legal scholar in his book, Dispelling the Myths of Abortion History, which I often reference in the stuff that I write, and I was thrilled to see Alito reference multiple times in his own opinion, in the majority opinion. What Delapino says is it's a mistake to look at abortion as it exists today and then broadcast that back into history and to try to understand it through medical knowledge that we have today, that it hasn't existed like it exists today for very long. And it's been a very small window. So quickening laws were the point when we knew that there was a living child inside of you. Why? Because we didn't have ultrasound technology. We didn't have the ability to look inside the womb and our Doppler to find the beating heart of the child. What we had to do was recognize you were probably pregnant based on some biological factors that you were experiencing, but we didn't know you were pregnant until quickening and you felt the movement of the child inside of you. And so this is Alito pushes back on this idea that it just because quickening laws exist didn't mean that abortion was embraced prior to quickening. What it meant was that people didn't know they were pregnant for sure until quickening happened. And then he points to both common law and then local laws and then some arguments by a particular jurist that were written out that demonstrate that they thought abortion was wrong at any point during the early life of that embryo or fetus. They didn't support it ever, but just under the law where you had quickening laws, it was the place where we knew that there was life and that the action that you were taking that life was destructive by nature. And he pushes back against all of that, all of those criticisms he finds. So I think that's the interesting thing about the difference between the leak and the final product, is that the final decision, he really does draw out those distinctions that are made from people that were pushing back at one time or another, trying to make it sound like the country was more tolerant of abortion than it was. And he provides a lot of historical evidence that all the way through 1973, the majority of the United States rejected abortion as a moral practice.
You know, that's really fascinating because, of course, you know, the mystery remains who leaked this initial draft, which side was it on? But regardless, it allowed the justices, specifically Justice Samuel Alito, to refine some of his arguments. So if someone was trying to say, you know, we are leaking this so that it's going to be bad for the pro-life movement, for example, I think it just strengthened his legal arguments. So, of course, you know, Roe v. Wade was back since the 70s. It's been almost 50 years. And what reasons did the majority give in overturning this case after all this time? And especially after affirming the right to an abortion in subsequent cases like Casey and even in Gonzalez versus Carhart, and which was the case that outlawed abortion known as partial birth abortion.
We said we've covered the idea of the legal part, right? That was his main thrust, because he says, and that's what's interesting, is he even points to the dissent that was written by the justices that would be identified as more liberal, particularly on the issue of abortion. And he says the dissent doesn't try to demonstrate a tradition or history of support for abortion. They just keep going back to stare decisis and saying this was already decided. And he said, I have already said that precedent matters and that there are standards for overturning precedent. So the first part is he goes back to the test that we talked about, determining whether it was a part of tradition or history and whether or not this is something that was implied in other enumerated laws. As he makes the case against that, he says, so now we have a decision that has impacted the ability of people all over the country to be able to pass laws or to legislate within their communities on this issue. He said it has bogged the court down and having to talk about this all the time. Is it time to overturn? Is it time for us to say, okay, look, we recognize the importance of stare decisis. We affirm the importance of stare decisis. But even Elena Kagan in the Marvel case, which I've mentioned before is one of my favorite Supreme Court cases ever, says that stare decisis isn't something that we have to do all the time. It's just when we have to protect the consistency of the court and the rulings. And so he says, let's give a 5-part test to overturning stare decisis. If we're going to say it has been affirmed over and over again, but if we look at what the affirmation was, the affirmation again and again was that it was decided in the past, not that the original decision was right. And if a correct view of history demonstrates that the original decision was wrong, now we have to see, was it wrong enough that overturning it is the right thing to do? And so he gives a 5-part strategy for doing it. He says, we have to look at the nature of the court's error. He gives examples like Plessy versus Ferguson, where he says that, is it so bad? Is it something that is hurting the people? Is it putting other people at risk? And in this particular case, the nature of the error was compelling enough. He makes a case because the interest in fetal life is being treated differently or treated the same as issues like contraception or what you do or practices of the privacy of your home sexually or relationships that you enter into. And he says, well, that's not the case, right? Everybody can acknowledge that destroying a human life, whether you recognize that life as valuable or not, that destroying a human life early in its development is of a different quality than the other things that we're discussing here. And so it deserves to be examined in a category all on its own. And so the right to privacy that was established that grounded the right to abortion as it pertains to things like gay marriage and contraception and to be able to look and read whatever material you want in your house and the privacy of your own home, those are issues of privacy that don't have a literal life being destroyed in the process of it. And so we can separate it from those. And the nature of the error was that it treated it as if it were one of those things, or at least part of that error. He says, number two, the quality of the reasoning. Was it reasoned through at a high level of quality? So even if we think it may be an error right now, does it have strong legal reasoning behind it? And he makes the case that absolutely does not. The workability of it, he asks, is it workable? Did this decision end up with a consistent ruling across all of the courts and make it easier for people to understand the law of the land. As a matter of fact, when he makes a case, compelling case, this has been a disaster judicially, right? You've had appellate courts against each other and state courts against appellate courts, and then the Supreme Court against appellate courts, and everybody arguing and trying to dig through the minutia of terms like undue burden. And what does it mean to be an undue burden for a woman getting an abortion? And how does the different ideas as far as interpretations of the different amendments. I mean, he said it's a mess. It's not workable. It has divided us on a legal level. It's an effect on other areas of law. And then finally, the reliance interest. He said, well, it will not upend concrete reliance interests like those developed in cases involving property rights, contract rights, privacy rights. Will stare decisis being overturned in this particular case hurt other areas? And so they go through very detailed explanation as to why all these other things that we may hear about in memes, or we see people panicking about online or Twitter and social media, they're coming after gay marriage, they're coming after contraception. They repeatedly say over and over again, this has nothing to do with that. We can overturn Roe v. Wade without you having to worry about losing those other issues, losing those other rights that have been affirmed, because it's a different quality of right that we're talking about. It's a different kind of action. It is unique. They use that term. It's a unique action. Abortion must be understood on its own terms and not in cooperation with a bunch of other issues. And so he says it was a poorly reasoned decision. And because of all of those things that we just talked about, those other standards, he says it is bad enough that the best thing that we can do now is overrule it and not appeal to prior precedent.
The decision in Roe versus Wade is nearly 50 years old. So what reasons did the majority of the Supreme Court justices, and I already mentioned that Justice Samuel Alito wrote the majority opinion, but he was joined by Justices Clarence Thomas, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett. What did that majority give as reasons for overturning Roe now after all this time? I mean, even after affirming the right to an abortion in subsequent cases like the 1992 ruling, which was Planned Parenthood v. Casey, or even in 2007 in the case Gonzalez v. Carhart, which was a decision that the Supreme Court made that actually upheld the Partial Birth Abortion Act of 2003.
Number one, the claim of the massive numbers of people that were dying of illegal abortions prior to Roe is wildly, wildly exaggerated. And we've given numbers in the past, what the CDC actually talks about, and I think it was something like 37 deaths attributed to illegal abortions in 1972, the year before, 25 deaths, by the way, attributed to legal abortions that same year. And you see, even in the years after, the numbers stay fairly consistent. They come down a little, but the combined numbers of the two kind of float around that same area. So the idea that all of these women were dying of illegal abortions at the time that abortion law happened in 1973 is wildly exaggerated. Now, if you want to go back into the early 20th century, there were larger numbers of women. There's several things that happened. We developed the ways to fight bacterial infections that didn't exist prior to that. There's interesting things where you see, I wrote an article a couple of years ago about how Lysol was used and people were using things like that to perform abortions. And one of the things that I point out in there is, like, if you look at it though, as the emergency room doctors began to recognize what they were seeing and the toxic nature of what was being used, because the women wouldn't tell the doctors what had happened. They were afraid to say why they were in there. They said, the doctors say we're able to start identifying that these are failed abortions or botched abortions or what these women have done. So if you see these, treat them. Even if the woman won't tell you what's happened to her, treat them, because that's what's happened. She's just lying to you because she doesn't want to get in trouble, or she doesn't want to admit what she's done. And so you see the medical profession getting better at treating those things. You see us getting better at treating everything altogether. And medical science advances so that abortion becomes much safer. When they talk about back alley abortions, one of the ideas is this: they're actually performing abortions in some back alley. That wasn't where the term came from. It came from back alley entrances to doctor's offices. Mary Calderon, I think back in 1969, testifying about the safety of illegal abortion, talks about how the overwhelming majority of abortions were performed by medical professionals. They were doing so secret and privately. So the back alley abortion was that idea of going in the back door so that people didn't see you coming and going. Of course, you did have what they alluded to, coat hanger deaths, but those were a very small minority. And that's always been somebody who is deeply troubled that goes down that path. But that's the past. I mean, you have even abortion advocates quoted recently, or not recently, in 2019, I think there was an article that was written where a pro-choice scholar said, look, this isn't 1970 or 1930 or anything like that. This is the medical abortions are over already 50% or more, over 50% of all the abortions that are gotten in the United States, well over 50% when you go over to Europe. These are people taking pills very early in pregnancy, and those pills are going to be how most people get their abortions. You shouldn't see women dying is what she says. She's like, that shouldn't be the result of what we're seeing here because the world has just changed since then. So these scare tactics of just screaming, women are going to die, women are going to die. Now that's not a comfort to me. Because I believe that there's no such thing as a safe abortion. I'm not of the opinion that those things. So when you talk about, but it is a comfort to the idea of when people think we're going back to this time where women will be dying in the streets and the hospitals will be flooded by injured women who tried to take a horrible action against themselves because they're terrified and found themselves pregnant. Look, if anybody self-administers abortion nowadays with something like a coat hanger, this is somebody who's mentally disturbed. They don't need access to abortion. They need help. They need a psychological professional, somebody that can be with them to help them navigate life and help them get back on their feet. But the danger then becomes you have somebody that's just unhinged and who doesn't understand the world that they live in. We're not at a place where it never was the case right prior to Roe v. Wade that was happening anyway. That was a long past history. And now it's even less likely to happen because the means for getting illegal abortions will no longer be back alley abortionists, but it'll be people getting things mailed to them from Europe. Where there's already many articles, by the way, talking about that. And of course, I've even commented on this before. They claim that the RU486 protocol or the medical abortion protocol is more safe than Tylenol. So they can't at one time say, oh, this is safer than Tylenol. It represents no danger. Anybody can do this at home without the help of a doctor. And as it's said in New York, anyone can prescribe it. You don't need a doctor to prescribe it. Get a nurse help to prescribe it. Get anyone at the center to give it to you. We're going to make it very easy for you to get it because it's so safe. And then at the same time, turn around and say, oh my gosh, women are going to be dying everywhere because they won't have access to abortion the same way they did before. Those two arguments are in complete contradiction. There's no such thing as a safe abortion anyway. But at that particular point, there's no risk of us going back to the 1920s.
Since you just started this discussion just about, is there such a thing as a safe abortion? I wanted to ask you about your current article in our journal, volume 45, number 1. Jay has a feature article titled The Problem with Improving Abortion, which he answers two New York Times op-ed pieces, of course, that came out before the overturning of Roe v. Wade. But they argue in those articles that Americans are more and more comfortable with abortions performed early in pregnancy because early abortion is less problematic than abortion later on. As a matter of fact, right before the decision on Roe came out, the New York Times has been publishing quite a lot on abortion, and they published an op-ed piece called Abortion Pills Will Change a Post-Roe World. And part of the thesis is the idea that women can get these medical abortions through pills. It's really going to blunt, frankly, for them, the fallout from Roe v. Wade being overturned because women won't have to go to Planned Parenthood offices or other doctors who are performing abortions, because if you need an abortion earlier on, you can easily do it with a pill. And, you know, that's part of their thesis, is that people are not really against abortion because it is so easy to do it through these means and people are more comfortable. So has abortion improved?
There you go to the idea. Can we improve abortion, right? Is that something that's even possible? Because And I talked about that you have two different ones. You have Jessica Valenti, who says that abortion used to be gross, right? It used to be a gross practice. And the gruesomeness that is used to try to make people turn away from abortion just won't apply anymore. I don't think that's entirely true. I do think that the RU486 or the medical abortion protocol used to be much more known as RU486 protocol. It has its own gruesomeness to it, especially if you read what women go through. But her point is well taken in the sense that the surgical abortions that lend itself to producing the kind of images that people use in abortion victim imagery are not the norm already. They're already not the norm. They're already not the majority. And that's just going to increasingly become the case. And so she believes as the gruesomeness of later abortion is taken away, abortion will just only become more and more acceptable. It's only if you accept the idea that early abortions are better than later abortions. I will agree that that is emotionally probably where everybody lives, right? Not everybody, where a large number of people in the United States live. They see early abortions as less problematic as later abortions because they are repulsed at the idea of aborting something that looks like them. And somebody asked me recently, they showed me a picture of a very early development human being. They said, are you saying you think this looks like a human being? I said, well, of course it looks like a human being. So assuming that that is a picture of a human embryo, that's just what a human being looks like at that stage. And so here we have to have some argument, right? It's no shock to me that we have disagreement on the issue of abortion. It's always funny to me when I see people online that act like they're shocked to find out that half the population of the United States thinks that abortion is a bad thing and how awful it is. So how could you be shocked? That has just been the reality of my life and the whole time I've been alive. So it's no shock that we have disagreement. But at this point, I was one time asked when I was in a panel, I was like, do you think intuitions, because I said, we have a human intuition that's wrong to kill other human beings. Most of us experience this. We believe that it's objectively morally wrong to kill other human beings. My job is to take that intuition and to help you apply it, not just to the human that you uncontroversially accept as one of us, but for the ones that you have for reasons that I don't fully, or that we haven't fully argued out yet. You think they don't qualify as one of us. And so I do believe that a lot of people in the United States have a problem looking at a human embryo and saying that's one of us because it lacks a lot of the capacities or visual cues they need to see it as one of us. So now we have a job to help educate them and inform them that from the very moment that life comes into existence, it's whole, distinct, living human beings. And so that, and the best way to ground our intuition of universal human dignity or these ideas of equal human rights is that the only thing that we all share equally is our shared humanity. So all human beings ought to be treated with dignity and respect at whatever stage of development they exist in. And so, yes, I do believe they're right in that there is a comfort with early abortion, but I think they're wrong in that the more we argue and discuss it, I believe that and now that abortion is no longer protected by Roe v. Wade, and it is going to have to be fought out in our communities. We're going to have arguments. We're going to have discussions. I do not believe that there is some destiny that we're pushing towards where people will continue to embrace early abortion, like particularly Valenti seems to think, oh, it's just going to become more and more comfortable for people. I disagree. More and more information will make it more and more uncomfortable for people. The better chance that we have to talk to people about our obligations and duties to other people, the more likely we're going to be able to convince them that even things that don't think look like us are one of us because all of us looked like that at one point.
So today that we're recording happens to be the day that the new Supreme Court justice has been sworn in, Ketanji Brown Jackson, and she's our 116th Supreme Court justice, and she replaces, of course, Justice Stephen Breyer. So the question is now that she is going to be seated on the court, and with the overturning of Roe, will there be another case that comes up? Do you think that they will accept that will challenge the most recent decision of June 2022? In other words, will they take another case dealing with abortion now that they have a new jurist on the bench?
Well, the makeup of the court is not favorable for them, even with a new, because she replaces somebody that was already on the dissent. And so you've seen over the 49 years that they've been doing it, and particularly the couple of decades that I've been involved in all of this, you have seen that people who file these legal cases are very tactical. They tend to look at the makeup of the court because precedent hurts. To build precedent on so if they turned around and tried to send it back right now, and the court just keeps refusing it, every time they refuse it, or every time they affirm that Roe v. Wade or that the federal court has no business arrogating the power to this to the federal judiciary, and any attempt that they try to get back to a Roe Casey paradigm will just end in more rejection and more rejection. And that just builds precedent upon precedent upon precedent. Now, as we've seen with the Dobbs ruling, precedent isn't everything, but it is enough that you have to address it. There's a reason that such a huge chunk of Alito's majority opinion is dedicated to justifying overturning precedent, because it still is a big deal. Even though they did it, they had to they had to give extreme justification for why it was okay to do it. And so you've seen, and historically speaking, lawyers for both sides try to be very tactical about when they send things to the court. So it would take a major shift of the makeup of the court. Because you say, it's a 6-3 in support of the Mississippi law, 5-4 in support of overturning Roe. Roberts isn't going to be your ally on reestablishing Roe. He didn't like the way that the law was. He just thought this was a step too far. And that's what he says is a concurring opinion. We didn't have to do this right now. And that's very Roberts. That's very way the Chief Justice operates. He hates these big, broad, sweeping changes. And he says, look, we had a very specific thing we could have decided on. We had a path where we only decided on this very narrow thing. And so if we'd taken that path, we wouldn't have had to do this big sweeping change. It wasn't necessary. To which Alito responded to Roberts, nobody wanted your solution, right? I mean, he actually says that in the majority of opinion. He calls it the concurring opinion. He doesn't, and he only mentions Roberts by name, I think, once, but he says he was offering a solution that nobody wanted, not the Solicitor General that was trying to protect Roe v. Wade, nor on behalf of Mississippi's law. Nobody wanted Roberts' solution. Roberts is making up out of thin air some middle path that he thinks would have made everybody happy. And Alito said, there's just no way to make everybody happy. We just got to follow the law and get rid of it. So there's no way to send it back right now that you have enough allies to do anything. So my guess is we would have to see a transformation of the makeup of the court before you saw legal challenges to it again. And it would be very difficult to get back a Roe environment at this point. Because you would have to do the hard work of demonstrating it, that this was wrongly decided. And Alito points out that the dissenters, all they have is stare decisis. They don't have an argument against his arguments that it's bad legal reasoning. They just have a continued pointing back to precedent and saying that should have stood because this has been the way it's been decided for 49 years.
I want to ask you about some of the other claims that relate to religion that are out there now that Roe has been overturned. So some people are claiming that the overturning of Roe actually violates their own religious freedoms. For example, they say that in certain Jewish communities, access to abortion is part of recognizing, for example, the sacred value of the life of the mother. So how do we respond to the claim that allowing laws against abortion actually violates the religious freedom of people?
Yeah, Sarah Seltzer did an opinion piece for the New York Times where she talks about this. And I've heard it from several different people online where they've said, you're violating my freedom to practice my religion because this is a part of our religion. Now, it is even Sarah Seltzer in her article or her opinion piece acknowledges that this isn't universally a held position by Jewish believers, that there are Jewish believers that are against abortion. But she says that this is her and a large enough group understanding of their Jewish duties and responsibilities to women to allow them to have access to abortion because they prioritize the sacredness of the life that exists in front of them over something that is potential but not yet independent. I personally try my hardest to read the people who disagree with me, particularly when they come from a minority position, and to understand what they're claiming their fears are. And in this particular case, I read that and I said, like, I get it, right? I get this sense that you are losing control of a cultural moment that you thought y'all had a hold of. And then I can see how you believe that there is a battle here between two different sacred views of human life, that yours is being subjugated to another. But that assumes that the pro-life cause is religious. I will say this. I think by far the single best hit article out there where it goes through point by point addressing things that are being said right now on the internet and supporting it from a pro-life position was put forth by a group called Secular Pro-Life. And you can go to their website, Secular Pro-Life, and look them up on Google. And they've put out some great stuff and always put out really strong stuff. And this group of people they're not arguing religiously at all. And neither do I, by the way. When I go to universities or talk to groups, if I'm standing in front of a group of people who disagree with me, and I have oftentimes in my life been in front of groups as large as 1,500 people who all hate what I'm saying, I never appeal to my beliefs as a Christian. I appeal to the science of embryology that tells us from the beginning of life, from the very first moment it comes into existence, it's a whole distinct living human being. And I appeal to philosophy to say that what makes us valuable is our shared humanity. And it's the best explanation of our universal intuition of human rights and human dignity, that all humans ought to be treated with dignity and respect. There's nothing particularly religious about those claims, or at least not on their face, they're not. And so we're able to find all sorts of agreement with secular voices out there who hate abortion and think that it's unjust and it's the unjust killing of an innocent human life. And they don't feel like they need to appeal to any particular religion or God to establish that. And I will say, if we take that too far, let's go to some place that hopefully isn't controversial. I have never met anyone in my talks or conversations with people and all of the travels that I've had that defend the position that Muslims ought to be free to practice female genital mutilation on their young daughters, even though it's an established religious practice among some groups of Muslims, not all Muslims. This is an Israelish practice, but against smaller groups of Muslims or some groups of Muslims that take this as a particularly important part because they believe it frustrates the sexuality of their daughter and protects her from the sins, all these different things that they believe about it. That's uncontroversially recognized that, look, I can respect your religion and your freedom to practice your religion, but you're not allowed to hurt other human beings as a practice of your religion, particularly against their will. And so I think there we can see that there have been some practices, even going further back in places where you saw even worse practices, where they have been, like, for example, when the British were colonizing India, one of the things that they dealt with was the Indian practice of burning the widows of men who had died on the pyre with the dead husband. They were burned alive. They said, this is our religious practice. And they pointed to that. So as we try to understand for the people who are fearing what's going on around us, I don't think we're in a position there where we have to just say, well, I guess I see it because you said it's a religion. Well, I think I have to be sensitive, but at the same time, I have to recognize that there's reasonable limits to religious practice. And if the best arguments tell us that the unborn are human beings from the moment they come into existence and that we owe them the same duty and responsibility that we owe to all other human beings, not the least of which is just to not kill them, then maybe I would suggest to you that the Jewish practitioners and the people of faith in the Jewish faith that believe abortion is wrong are right about this, and maybe talk to them and see if you can come to some common understanding within your own faith about why those people disagree with you and why the culture or community may be moving against you on this particular case. But it's not a particularly religious position to say that you shouldn't kill other human beings. And there's nothing religious about arguing for the humanity of embryonic or fetal human life based on their biological humanity and by common or sound philosophical reasoning about what human beings we ought to treat well and what human beings we ought to be free to kill. I'm just one of those people that says there's no human beings we ought to be free to kill without extreme, extreme justification.
So one of the other common claims now post Roe being overturned is there are people saying that the United States is now totally going back to the dark ages. I mean, it's embarrassing. We are now out of step with the rest of the world by limiting abortion, just as other countries are expanding abortion. So is the U.S. going back to the dark ages? Is this something that's an extreme move that really doesn't reflect other countries and abortion access in them?
We were already extreme. I mean, if you look at what was going on of an abortion law over the rest of the world, there were only six other countries in the world that allowed abortion after 20 weeks without there being some risk to the health of the mother. When you talk to people in Europe, particularly like England or Germany, we talk to people there about where there's restrictions on when abortion can happen, and they encourage very early practice of abortion. And you tell them that in the United States, under the Roe v. Wade, Doe versus Bolton, Planned Parenthood versus Casey paradigm that we lived under, that abortion was legal through all 9 months, as long as you appealed to the health exception, which could be emotional health, familial health, and always, as was in the Doe versus Bolton decision and affirmed in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, all judgments had to be on the side of the mother. And those judgments by the doctor could never be on the side of the unborn child. They would look at you like that was just like you're crazy. That can't be the law, right? That can't be the way the United States practices abortion law. So if there is a sense that we have swung back too far from people that support abortion rights, I would say that the swing back too far, and it's a corrective because we were too extreme and we were out of step with the rest of the world. Every time I would hear people say, well, oh my gosh, these extremists who want to limit abortion access to 15 weeks is what was going on in Mississippi. But that's eminently reasonable compared to most other countries around the world. It was only in the United States that it sounded crazy because we were letting them do it all the way through if they could find a doctor that was willing to say it was a reason to concern themselves with the health of the woman. And so stricter standards doesn't make us out of touch with the rest of the world. It actually brings us back in line with where most of the rest of the world is. Of course, Canada, the Netherlands, Vietnam, China, places like that are still have broader access to abortion than we do, but not the rest of the world. And this puts us much more in line with where they are. And I think that I was talking to a pro-life philosopher a couple of years ago, and he and I were doing an interview, and he said, I think that at the end of the day, when you return it to the people, you'll have states that restrict it altogether. You'll have states that allow it, even like they're being allowed today, or even more so. He said, and then I think you're going to have states that end up somewhere like Europe, where it's just going to be allowed very early, but only very early. So the corrective does not make us extreme. The corrective actually gets us more in line with where the rest of the world is.
So earlier in this podcast, you talked about how some folks are now claiming that this overturn of Roe is just the beginning of attack on freedoms, you know, from not just abortion, but contraception, gay marriage. And specifically, I've seen articles even on the New York Times that suggest that the government or states will be involved in cracking down on women traveling to get abortions or being able to get a medical abortion through pills through the mail and that kind of thing. And so these are all new intrusions into our private life, they say. So should people be concerned about new governmental invasions of privacy as they police abortion, and are other all kinds of other rights at risk, including things like the ability to get contraception or even gay marriage?
Yeah, they say it's interesting to see how that those claims are played out, because clearly people aren't reading the decision themselves. They're relying on other people to tell them what's in the decision. For example, there's been a lot made out of the idea that Clarence Thomas, in his concurring decision, he takes issue with what's called the due process clause of the 14th Amendment. If you read the 14th Amendment in the first section, it says all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. And here is the clause that where a lot of this comes from. Nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. That right there, that one clause about without due process of law, that is what is being used legally to justify abortion and a whole host of other things, with grounding the right to freedom. So much is being made out of the fact that Clarence Thomas doesn't like the due process clause as a weapon for the Supreme Court to use to make broad sweeping rulings that it shouldn't be making and detaching the community from the ability to vote on these issues. So Clarence Thomas mentions all of these things that were decided by the due process clause should be at risk one way or another. But that is his concurring opinion. He's not saying that the abortion decision is going to put those at risk. He actually says the opposite. He says, we're not coming for abortion. He just says that unlike the majority that signed, he thinks the due process clause is more problematic than they do, and that things that have been decided on it are standing on legally shaky ground, and that they could be revisited in the future. But nobody signed on that with him. That was just Clarence Thomas opining about his position on the due process clause. And I don't think anybody that's ever read him before would be surprised about the things that he was saying. Majority opinion consistently says we cannot hold those other rights that you have to the same standard as abortion, because in those rights, no life is being destroyed. It's a different kind of discussion. And as to the travel thing, again, going to the explicitly stated decision, Kavanaugh has a concurring opinion that he wrote where he says, you are free to travel. He said, could this ever be used to pass laws to restrict people's travel between states? And he says, no, that would be unconstitutional. So that law would not pass the freedom, because you have the right for interstate travel. You have the right to trade and interstate commerce. You have the right to move around the United States. That is part of your fundamental freedoms, and that would not be restricted because of these laws. And so It is explicitly stated repeatedly over and over again, not just in the majority opinion, but even in a concurring opinion by Kavanaugh, where he directly addresses the issue of travel, that these things will not be affected by this decision. You have those freedoms. We're not coming after them. And the only evidence that they have that the court is now on some radical agenda is that Thomas says, look, I just don't like the due process clause. Thomas doesn't say anything else about all those other things, like I hate them and I want them gone. What he says is that using the due process clause to get things done legally puts them on shaky ground, and that those things could one day be revisited. And because of the shakiness of due process, a court that has maybe an originalist view or bent like this one does may be able to find trouble with those. And so we ought to be mindful of the fact that due process has been used in Clarence Thomas's mind to make some broad changes that probably shouldn't have been made. So the fear that all of these things are going to be on the table now and the Supreme Court's coming after them. I mean, I've seen memes and political cartoons and people panicked, like really panicked online. Oh my gosh, they're coming after us. They're coming after us. They're not coming after you. They've said they're not coming after you. They've repeatedly said that the legal reasoning that takes care of this would not apply to any of those other things. And Kavanaugh explicitly said there will be no limits on your travel, because if anybody ever tried to do that, he would say it's unconstitutional and vote that way from the Supreme Court. Roberts certainly would. And then you would have the three justices that were on the dissent. So you have five right there already that would never allow that sort of thing to happen legally. You'd have to have a major shift in the makeup of the court to get anything done like that. So it's a lot of fear and fear mongering, which is good to get people motivated, but it's not based on anything that's happening in reality. I think that people should just take a moment and relax and see what I think there's a great quote from Edmund Burke one time when he was asked why he wasn't writing very supportive of the French Revolution. And he said, because before I write in support of things, I want to see the actual result of what was going on, right? He said, I'm not one to go out there and celebrate and write big pieces that think this is a great thing when I don't know that it's a great thing. We'll see if it's a great thing when it has time to get going and to work. People need to take a deep breath, whether they lost or they feel like they won, and they need to be able to see what is going to be the result of this, both immediate and as we go forward in the future, not to try to find the most apocalyptic outcomes and run around warning everybody to delete apps on their phone because the government's going to chase them down, or anything like the things that we've seen or talked about, or fear that the government's going to be there waiting for you if you try to go out of the state and stop you at the lines and ask you all sorts of intrusive questions about why you're traveling.
Now, you just mentioned deleting apps off your phone. Again, the New York Times, they have quite a lot of coverage on abortion. They published a news article just talking about some concerns that pro-choice women have about using monthly cycle tracking apps, because they feel like it might be a source of information for authorities that will intrude on their reproductive health decisions. So there's kind of like a little bit of a paranoia there to even use that, because they claim that, you know, digital information that you enter into these apps is going to put women at risk. Is that true? Using a monthly cycle tracking app would put the reproductive health decisions of pro-choice women at risk?
If you projected out a future where the government was aggressively prosecuting women for attempting to or getting abortions, and they were looking for evidence to prosecute them, then you could say, well, digital trails matter. There's a couple of things I'd like to say in response to this, all of the hysteria we were talking about in the previous question and to this question. One of the things that is often said to people, I understand that what I'm saying here is a large number of people, but when you say one in four women will have had an abortion during their reproductive stages of life, that's a lot. In the United States, one in four women will have had it. That is a lot. I concede that, right? But the opposite is true then. Three out of four women don't, statistically. It's more right now. The stats are more than three out of four women will not get an abortion during their reproductive years in life. So 75% of women will never access abortion in the United States at the current rate that we're seeing in the United States right now. There's no reason to believe that those numbers will go up because it becomes illegal. And so in the areas where it becomes illegal. So you're talking about something that 75% of women it will never impact their life at all. They aren't going to get abortions. They don't get abortions. They live their entire life without getting it. And they live presumably fulfilling and productive and successful lives without access to abortion. And so the idea that every woman out there right now needs to delete apps from their phone that's tracking their menstrual cycles is just, it's paranoia. It's nonsense, right? By the way, prior to Roe v. Wade, we didn't prosecute women. We prosecuted doctors. There's a lot of pragmatic reasons for that. And there are groups of people that are out there now more than ever before that are pushing what they call the equal protection of the unborn, so that women should be prosecuted for murder, because what they say that is that women know what they're doing. And a lot of these people will tell you from personal experiences that they talk to women. This is still a small number of group that it's bigger than it once was. But it's never happened before. And as I've talked to people who have asked me about it, it's like, what does it matter where I stand on this spiritually or whether I stand on it morally? And as we're having this discussion right now, I can't understand how you would overcome the pragmatic difficulties in that kind of a prosecution or in that kind of a way of going about things. This is the reason why we only prosecuted doctors before and we weren't running around prosecuting women. The fear that they're going to be able to digitally track them comes from cases where it is either strongly believed or almost universally understood that a woman gave birth to a child and killed the child right after it was born. And you see this in cases where the situation's too grisly to go into the details, but where they find a woman or they come across a case where they find odd disposal nature of the child that doesn't fit a woman who says, I just had a miscarriage. So the woman claims they just had a miscarriage, but the remains of the child exist in such a way that seems implausible based on what they're saying. And so when they have a case like that where they're suspecting infanticide, what they do is they look for a trail of the woman seeking abortion, and they look for a digital trail. And if they find it, they say, it's easy to believe that you might have been desperate enough to kill your child after it was born, since we have all of these searches and questions that you've put forth and efforts to procure information about online abortions for whatever reason that they weren't seeking them from seeking professional help or people in their community. So they too far along, they couldn't find anybody to do it, whatever the case was. And so they point to that and they say, look, there's a digital trail that's been left and it's been found to prosecute women who had miscarriages. That's not the case. These are not women who just had miscarriages. These are women who are suspected and with their strong evidence often and almost universally accepted often committed infanticide against a child that had just been born. And the case is being made to prosecute them for the killing of that child. And that's when that digital thing, it's not because going into the future, we're going to be using apps to search out every decision the woman, everything they've ever searched for and every menstrual cycle they've ever had to try to pin a case on them that they were pregnant and now are not. That's just paranoia and not consistent with anything that we've ever seen throughout the history of prosecutions on abortion prior to Roe v. Wade.
So whenever these kinds of decisions come out that are just, you know, fairly significant, different groups, you know, when it comes to events might claim responsibility for things or say that they will want to, you know, be involved in some way. I am thinking of, you know, groups like what happened with the pipeline. There were some eco-terrorist groups and those things. And even on the pro-life side, there have been people like, okay, if we can't use, you know, legal means, we're going to track down abortion doctors and kill them. So there's a group out there calling themselves Jane's Revenge, and they have promised to attack pro-life groups and, you know, with kind of their little unofficial slogan, you know, if abortion isn't safe, you aren't either. And of course, they engage in similar kinds of tactics that eco-terrorists do, you know, vandalism and arson and destroying property and those kinds of things. So is this a concern? What have they done to this point? Or are they just really kind of a fringe small group?
It's always difficult when you're talking about groups like this to know whether or not what you're seeing are copycats or whether what you're seeing is the real thing. I will say there, and I don't know the exact number right now, there have been, I think 13 was the last number I saw, but I may be mistaken there, but there have been multiple attacks against pregnancy centers, empty pregnancy centers where they're firebombed at night. Interestingly enough, oftentimes in blue state is where this is happening. I say that interestingly enough because they're attacking and writing, if abortion ain't safe, you aren't either. If abortion isn't safe, you aren't either. Whatever they're writing on the sides of these particular buildings. And they're doing it in places where abortion's actually safe. I mean, it happened in Buffalo, happened in Wisconsin, it happened in, I believe, Oregon. And so there are cases where they're firebombing or vandalizing and spray painting on pregnancy centers. overnight. And they have a list that they've compiled, and they have a website where they put out their information, and they try to get people to go by and attack it. One of the lists, there was an article recently that the list had been made public by two professors at the University of Georgia who had compiled a list of all of the pregnancy centers in the country, and they'd made it public because their idea was to protest or to go against these public because they see them as fake medical centers, which is ridiculous. All of them that are medical centers are legit medical centers that follow medical practices. But I've worked with many of them, and I'm on the board of one of them, and the level of operation, of excellence in their operation is unparalleled. I mean, the medical group that worked first rate, they firebomb them and attack them, and they've done this also to some political offices as well. They promised a night of rage on the decision day. That didn't deliver. It didn't happen. There was no night of rage. They weren't out there everywhere. They have disrupted some Catholic churches. They have vandalized Catholic churches. They have disrupted other church services. And they have firebombed a few pregnancy centers. And they have vandalized a few other pregnancy centers. And they claim it's all Jane's revenge. But like any of these groups, who knows who's actually doing and what they're doing. They've made grandiose claims about what they're going to do, and they haven't lived up to any of those yet. But any act of effort to terrorize, that's basically what you're doing right at that point. I mean, it is terrorizing people. It's trying to build fear in them about going places that they would normally go and to do the things that they would normally do under the auspices that, you've done something we don't like. And as long as you continue to do it, we're going to continue to try to make you afraid. If abortion isn't safe, you aren't safe either. So it is whatever level of terrorism that you want to call it. It is a level of attempt to terrorize people and to fundamentally change the way that they approach life and the way that they're doing their business based on a fear of reprisals from this particular group. They haven't managed to do what they claim they're going to do. They have managed to do some terrible things to some places. It ought to be taken seriously. There are right now efforts to get Merrick Garland, the Attorney General of the United States, to take this more seriously and to look into what's going on. So far, it's been sort of a shrug of the shoulders that we're getting from authorities saying, you had to think something like this was going to happen. I think if they try to meet their more grandiose claims about what they're going to do, they're going to also draw ultimately attention from people that will have to act and react to what's going on. Hopefully, you would think so. It hasn't amounted to what they've claimed it has, but what they've done has been, terrible. And I do agree with you, by the way. I want to just really quickly say, one of the worst conversations I had recently, when you said that we've seen this from the pro-life side as well, was my younger daughter, 13 years old. I mean, she's not a baby or anything, but she and I were talking and she said, oh, pro-lifers have never been violent, right? And it's, oh my gosh, yes. And so we had to go through some of the violent history of people who have claimed to be acting on behalf of the pro-life side or on God's side. And it was terrible, right? It's a terrible thing to have to recognize that people who agree with you on this larger issue were so animated by their hate or anger or their own self-righteousness and identification as God's justice that they killed other human beings. That we would kill other human beings in defense of the principle of life like that is, to me, anathema to Christian teaching. And it was heartbreaking to have to answer to my daughter, who believes so strongly in the pro-life cause, I guess because so many people in her life are pro-life and she loves them, that they would never behave like that. It's like, well, no, those people wouldn't, but people have, and they've done terrible things.
So I want to kind of wrap us up with a few questions for you about the future mission and vision of the pro-life movement. So now that Roe v. Wade has been overturned, where does this leave the pro-life movement? I mean, what does it look like them going forward in a post-Roe world? And that speaks probably directly to you too, because those are the kinds of organization that you have that had focused on this before. So does that change the mission and vision of pro-life organization?
It changes it. Like this was a, like, was this a win? Yes. Was it a total win? No, it was a win that was necessary to get to the next step. I was talking to a group recently in Kentucky before all this came down. And I said, if Roe was overturned, it's important that everybody in this room knows that what we have been fighting for 49 years is the right to fight. And that's what happens next, right? We weren't allowed to fight abortion because every effort that we made to frustrate abortion in our community was then frustrated by Roe v. Wade, Planned Parenthood versus Casey. That's gone. We live in a post-Roe world. And now I think what's interesting is that for decades, there have been people that have said, this is an intractable issue. It's too big. There's nothing you can do about it. It's the law of the land. A lot of people who have made excuses now for decades who would tell you that I am positionally or emotionally on the pro-life side, but I'm not active because I just don't think my voice matters. That's over. Everybody's voice matters now. And now it's time to convince your neighbor of the value of human life. And now it's time to go out to our communities and convince them that we can be better. One of the mantras that we've tried to take up in our organization is that we can do better than abortion and we can be better than this. And that we have to have that message for the community that if you're panicked, like you see this fear, right? This fear, because we're going to lose this and our way of living is going to go away. And I recognize that fear. And now we have to turn our attention to them and say, we can be better than what we've been. And we can do better. We can offer better solutions to the problems that are driving people to abortion than abortion. And we have to do this as a community. So now we have to turn our attention away from the federal government, particularly the judiciary branch. And we have to look at our neighbors and say, now what we say to our neighbor matters more than ever. Now what we can convince them of, how they vote in our local elections, how we put the people that we have in our state legislators. You've been very interested in what's going on in national politics, but most people couldn't tell you who represents them on a state level. Now you better figure out who those people are. You better figure out who the people in your local communities are. Now it's going to be a time for local action and for an effort to convince everybody around you that there is a better way to take care of our community than abortion, and that the unborn are human and ought to be treated with dignity and respect. Now the fight begins, but it's a different fight. It's going to require you to rally your community rather than to fight this establishment. And I think that's a great thing. I really do. I really think that transitioning to a place where it hopefully will get away from some grandstanding, right? I'm not a big fan of grandstanding. I'm not a big fan of people seeing themselves in this large, I guess it's just, you know, personally, I think the humility of Christians ought to drive us to see ourselves as the body of Christ and everybody serving a specific role. And anytime I see somebody who is trying to make it about them, I get a little bit nervous. Well, now it doesn't matter because grandstanding means nothing. Now it's going to be, how do we do in local elections? And anybody who's ever worked elections will tell you that the way you win an election is you go door to door. The way that you win elections is that you be there in your community and the people see you. One of the things that Hillary Clinton was criticized for and why she lost to Donald Trump, as a friend of mine who ran elections, he was an election and he was also a high ranking guy in a particular government, head of a state Republican Party. And this was a guy who had managed elections in the past. He said the reason they failed was because they weren't there. When the days were coming to an end, they weren't out there in force. They believed that everybody was on their side and they didn't do the door-to-door, face-to-face, out there talking to people, trying to convince them of the rightness of their position. So that's where we're going now, right? Now where it's no longer fight the power, the institutional power in Washington, D.C. Now it's convince your neighbor of the rightness of your position and have them working in local elections. Now it's about the people around you and changing their minds. And so it will shift. And I think it's a great time. It's a great thing that we're moving into this case because now being convincing will have greater results than we could have ever imagined. And we cannot believe it's over. We cannot believe that. You cannot believe that just because we won here that we're done. That's not the way this works, right? You can look back in history. We don't have to go look back that very far to see. I mean, in the reelection campaign of George Bush, many people credited him winning that was because there was all these state referendums on gay marriage. And there was this celebration that night. Oh my gosh, we defeated gay marriage all over every state that had it. How long did it take for that to turn? Because the entire power of the culture turned to affirming that gay marriage was a good. And the songs and the TV shows and the movies and the plays and the articles, and there was nothing that could be done in the face of that sort of cultural assault. That's exactly what we're about to see with people like Pink going on Twitter and saying, if you're a pro-lifer, don't listen to my music, and the pressure that you're going to start to see coming from all of these different places and everybody affirming a right to abortion. If we don't recognize that this is the beginning of our fight, that we fought for the right to fight, and now the winning of that fight is going to be being in front of our neighbors, talking to them, convincing them, if we don't seize this moment and become personally invested in the lives of our community, it's amazing how fast people can turn when the culture goes against us. And we are about to feel the full weight of the culture. And so now we're going to have to steel ourselves for how we get our message out that we can do better than abortion and we can be better than this in the face of the blowback that we're about to receive from the people that set the cultural agenda.
So how should pro-lifers characterize the overturning of Roe v. Wade? In other words, should they just say, well, we won?
We won that battle. The first battle we won. And it's a huge battle. I think we should be happy, right? I think it's so weird to see people. I thought Kevin DeYoung just wrote a great piece about it, comparing the celebrating of the end of Roe v. Wade to the celebration of the destruction of the Death Star at the end of Star Wars. And it's a great piece if you find it online, where he says, you know, how did Star Wars end? Remember when they came back from the Death Star and everybody told them, hey, tamper your excitement. And there's people out there that are sad that the Death Star is gone. So don't upset them. And he goes through all the, and they say, no, of course not. We celebrated the end of the Death Star because it was a killing machine. And I think that's just such a great, great piece that Kevin DeYoung wrote. Because it points out, this is a good thing. We have to celebrate this moment because it got us somewhere that we weren't before. And there's nothing wrong with celebrating it. And there's nothing wrong with being happy about it, because it is a major victory without which all other possible victories would not be possible, right? This was the thing that made everything else that we're going to be able to do possible. And so we have to celebrate it. Celebrate within the context of what's happened. So, and celebrating is a big deal. I think that gloomy people have a tendency to lose sight of the fact that we need to celebrate moments in our life. It's a guy who works also with people in my community in sports. It's funny to me. I talk to college coaches, or you talk to college coaches, and they'll tell you that one of the things that we're looking for in young athletes is the ability to celebrate small victories, and not just their own, the victories of their teammates. Like, something good happens on the field and they want to see that person saying, yeah, cheering for them, cheering on their teammates. And ask them why. Why is celebrating so important? When you talk to these college coaches, Division I coaches are looking for elite athletes. They're also looking for elite attitudes. And they say the same thing. They say it's hard. The journey's hard. The work is hard. And oftentimes it is littered with failure. And if you can't celebrate the little things, you won't be able to find the motivation to keep going. Being able to enjoy everything, all of the victories along the way, is what makes the next victory possible. And ultimately, the biggest victories imaginable. So is this a win for us? Yes. And we should celebrate it, and we should be happy about it. And we should rejoice that opportunities now exist that have never existed in my lifetime since I was 1 year old. But at the same time, we have to put it in context of a greater battle. And now we have to be mindful of everything that's coming next. And as I mentioned before, that's the cultural movement. As I mentioned before, that's going to be the need for us to be active in our communities. We're going to have to rally the forces that have sat around for a decade or two decades saying, oh, I don't want to get involved in this. It's just a political issue. Well, it's not just a political issue anymore. It's your community. And do you approve of this happening in your community? And if you don't, then we have to make our voices heard. And we're going to have to push back against the people that are going to come with everything that they've got now to claim ground on politics, because, you know, they're not going to just give up. They're gonna figure out after they throw their tantrum online that the fight is, and they're gonna go after that as well.
So far in this very in-depth conversation we've been having about the aftermath of the Supreme Court overturning Roe versus Wade in June 2022, you know, we've talked about some legal issues and kind of clarifying those. We've talked about various different argumentation from pro-abortion people who are having concerns post-Roe being overturned. And you've even mentioned how people who are pro-life can be involved in their community, even with some political activity, as they, you know, uphold human life. But as part of the podcast that we have for the Christian Apologist, I want to ask you, how, as a Christian, do you see this through the lens of a biblical worldview? So could you speak to that?
You know, up to this point, I've talked in a way that might sound purely political. When I talk about things like going door to door and learning our representatives' names on a local level and advocating for policies within our communities that are life-affirming, to build life-affirming communities. But it's not meant to be purely political. What it's meant to be is purely personal. That every one of us has to take the responsibility and duty to go out to our communities and advocate for the value of human life. As a Christian, I believe that all human beings are the image bearers of God, that we are created to reflect his image in the world around us. Our moral agency, our creativity, our rational capacities, all of these are things that reflect God in the world around us. So we can join in his great work in growing the kingdom and efforts to spread the gospel and representing the mercy of Christ and the grace of Christ and the justice of Christ in the world around us. I talk about it when I go out on the road and speak sometimes about James chapter 4, verse 17. And there, built off the message, where it says, any man who knows the good that he ought to do, anyone who knows the good that they ought to do and doesn't do it, sins. Now, what that is a sin of omission. So it's not like the sins of commission, the things that we do, the lying, the cheating, the stealing, the actions that we take that separate us from God. But this is a sin of omission, where we have something that God would have us do, and that we know that we ought to be doing this thing, and we fail to do it, and we fill our lives up, maybe even sometimes with very important things, but in our failure to do that thing, our failure to serve that act of righteousness in our community, it's a sin. And I try to make the case by establishing the full humanity of the unborn, both through the science of embryology, telling us from the moment they come into existence, they're whole and living human organisms, and from philosophy, saying that what is the best explanation for our intuition of universal human dignity and universal human rights is that our value is grounded in our shared humanity. And when I make that case that all human beings ought to be treated with dignity and respect, I'm making a case that we have a responsibility, every one of us, a good that we ought to do is to advocate for the value of that human life. And there's so many ways to do that, because there's been so many pro-lifers actively in our community setting up organizations that do different things that serve different parts of the body of Christ. Crisis pregnancy centers meet them in their need and provide them with resources and counseling, trying to help them and alleviate those fears and those concerns and those felt needs that are driving them towards this decision. You have sidewalk counselors who are meeting them at the moment of crisis that they're about to make this decision, trying to encourage them that their community is ready to come alongside them and help them to make a more life-affirming choice. And all of these things, whether you get involved politically, whether you get involved in crisis pregnancy centers, whether you get involved with counseling, whether you get involved with just praying for people and financially supporting pro-life organizations that are actively already out there working, all of these things do more than just their efforts to save human life through saving the unborn from abortion, which if that was all they did, that's enough. But what they also do is help us to get in line in a right relationship with God. Remember, the two great commandments are to love the Lord your God with all that we are and all that we have to give him. And then the second one is to love our neighbor as ourselves. And the unborn are our neighbors. And anytime we understand that and we act in accordance with that and help others act in accordance with that, then we help them to live more in the likeness of Jesus Christ. We spread the mercy and grace and strength of character into our community by confronting something as evil as abortion in a Christ-like way. We take a message that not only do you matter, but so does the unborn child, and all of us have inestimable worth in the eyes of God, who created us to be in an everlasting relationship with him, restored through the resurrection of his son, Jesus Christ. And so it's more than just fighting abortion to save the lives of the unborn. It's fighting abortion to convince the culture around us that there is a better way, and that we can live a life more in line with the character and person of Jesus Christ. We can be better than this. We can do better than abortion. Not just the sin of killing the child, but the sin of ignoring the destruction of life around us. We have a personal responsibility. And so all of this talk about it, as we go into a post-Roe America, isn't just about pure politics. It's pure personal responsibility and duty. All excuses have been lifted from us. We can now make decisions that impact the world around us in a way that we couldn't just a couple of weeks ago. And the reason that we ought to be doing that as Christians is because the people we seek to save, both the unborn and those who would do terrible things to the unborn, are the image bearers of God. And when we save those lives, we save lives of inestimable worth. And when we help people live in accordance with the gospel of Jesus Christ and represent him in this community and to live more in the light of Christ by loving our neighbors as ourselves, we build a community that spreads the grace and mercy of Jesus Christ to the world around us in a way that can't be done as long as we accept death as an answer to the challenges of life.
Well, on a much lighter note, I want to end with a fun rapid fire question for Jay about the summer. So for summertime eats, watermelon or corn on the cob?
Oh my gosh. I would have said watermelon most of my life, but I am a huge fan of like street corn on the cob, right? I mean, when they just put all that garbage on it, I just cannot get enough of that. And so corn on the cob.
Well, thanks, Jay, for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to episode 296 of the Postmodern Realities podcast. From the Christian Research Journal, today's guest was Jay Watts. We did a very deep dive into a lot of the issues facing the pro-life movement post Roe v. Wade being overturned, as well as just talking about and answering some of the newer apologetics by pro-abortion proponents that they have been writing about since Roe versus Wade was overturned. As I mentioned, Jay has written a feature article for the Christian Research Journal in our current issue, volume 45, number 1. His article is called The Problem with Improving Abortion. If you don't already subscribe, since we barely touched on the article, you won't want to miss it and hear what he has to say about the ways in which pro-abortion people think that abortion can be improved and how he refutes that. In addition, as I mentioned, in the next print issue, Jay will be doing an in-depth treatment of a lot of the issues that we covered on the podcast. So thank you for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast and for subscribing to the Christian Research Journal. Stay connected with the Christian Research Institute and all the new content we have coming your way. The best way to do that is to head on over to our website, equip.org. There you will find thousands of free resources right at your fingertips, from articles to video to audio, and it's all for free. You'll find our podcasts hosted there, as well as the Bible Answer Man broadcast, which is hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and streams live every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. In addition, you don't want to miss out on subscribing to Hank Unplugged, which is the podcast of Hank Hanegraaff. And it's in that podcast he has really in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people. And in addition, he has a new series on his podcast feed called Hank Unplugged Shorts, which Hank goes into the headlines in the mainstream media and refutes a lot of those cultural issues that we have in these short podcast episodes. And there's quite a few of them. You don't want to miss out on them. Now, if you want to find some of this at other places where it's all in one place, really subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's a great way to get all of our content there, our podcasts there, and different individual questions theologically that people have that Hank answers at our YouTube channel. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, I don't know how to subscribe to YouTube. I don't have a YouTube account. Well, actually, you might just have a YouTube account. If you have a Gmail address, you have a YouTube account. Just log into YouTube with your Gmail address and search for Bible Answer Man channel, and please become one of our subscribers. In addition, if you see that bell icon right there on our front page, please click that. And every time that we have new content, you will receive a notification that new content is up on our channel for you to be able to consume. So thank you so much for the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute. We are grateful for you listening and reading and watching.